Hello to my friends and correspondents everywhere. This is Gray Barker, and this tape is being made available as a part of the dissemination of my research into the mysteries of the Allende letters, the annotated edition of the case for the UFO, the apparent suicide of Dr. M.K. Jessup in 1959, and other matters that still remain mysteries and are of great interest to various students of ufology. Now, this recording is just being made informally. It's not being read, or it's just from a few notes, so I hope you will pardon the way it's made. But it's just as if I would be sitting here talking to you about this, and that's how I would like to proceed. Some of you listening to this tape has already read the annotated edition of the case for the UFO by Dr. M.K. Jessup, the facsimile edition that I reprinted and have been distributing for some years now. Those of you who have read this, I'm sure this tape will mean a great deal more to you than those who haven't. And to those who are thoroughly familiar with Jessup, Allende, the alleged disappearing ship, etc., I hope that you will pardon me while I just sketch out some things briefly in case the person listening to this tape is not too familiar with these things. The mystery of the annotated edition, I suppose, started back in 1955 when Bantam Books published a paperback of Dr. Jessup's book, The Case for the UFO. Well, that wasn't too mysterious, but it was when a copy of this book was mailed into Washington to the Office of Naval Research. There was a lot of peculiar scribbling in this book in three shades of blue ink, evidently written by three different mysterious people, calling themselves Mr. A, Mr. B, and Gemini. These annotations were almost alien in their character, very, very strange, and we don't know how it came about, but for some reason, possibly because of his allusions to a secret naval experiment, this book surfaced in a very peculiar edition sometime afterward. A company in Garland, Texas, named the Vero Manufacturing Company, was given this annotated edition by the military, and in the office of this firm, which manufactured electronics gear for the military, it was laboriously typed out on offset stencils, and the annotations that were written in were printed in a different color of ink. If you've seen the annotated edition, you know what I mean. Then a limited number of copies of these were distributed. Also, in this book were reproduced some very strange letters that Jessup had received from a Carl M. Allen or a Carlos Miguel Allende, previous to the annotations being sent in. The most interesting thing about these letters were that they described an experiment which allegedly took place at sea, and during which a destroyer with all its crew became invisible due to the utilizing of the principles of Einstein's unified field theory. According to these letters, the experiment went wrong in some ways. Some of the crew froze or were unable to recover from the invisibility imposed by the strange field, and they could be brought back by a strange laying on of hands ceremony by crew members or by sophisticated equipment hurriedly readied after the experiment went awry. We don't have time to go into all that now, but if you have read the letters, you will know what we're talking about. For years, people had heard about copies of this book, but had never seen one. After I obtained a copy and reprinted it, however, it's more generally known. And a great many questions began to surface. For one thing, who was Carlos Miguel Allende? Did he actually exist? Was he one of the people who annotated the strange copy of the paperback sent into Washington? Well, no one could prove anything because no one could locate Allende, and the mystery just went along. However, During the last couple of years, a Yendi, or at least a man claiming to be a Yendi, suddenly surfaced and began to show up and talk to people and write letters to people. Finally, I was able to have a meeting with a Yendi in the company of fellow researcher James W. Mosley, and we asked him some questions, and he consented that we record his answers on a tape. One of the amazing revelations that came from a Yendi was that not only did he write the letters, but that he did the complete annotations, so he claimed, by being able to change his handwriting and to write in three different handwriting styles. I don't know if this proves that this man that we're going to hear is the actual Yendi. The mystery of that and the research that's been done would take up far too much time. But anyhow, here for your you to use your own judgment on is that interview with a Yendi. To whether there is a Yendi or whether a Yendi has disappeared. And well, I would like for you to identify yourself on the tape so that people can be sure that they are indeed hearing a Yendi.
Mi nombre es señor Foreman, Carlos Miguel Allende y Allende, de Ciudad Guadalajara, Estado de Jalisco, México, señor, a sus órdenes y servicios.
Excellent. Now, Allende has been associated in the minds of a great many ufologists as the author of certain annotations in the book The Case for the UFO. Would you identify yourself as the author of those annotations?
I can, and I will. See here, on my right, long finger.
Yes.
It is scarred, as you two witnesses here. James?
Yes.
Morley?
Mosley.
And Ray Barker?
Yes.
You too witness this finger and can see. It is scarred.
Yes.
And the top of it is once off and the nail has been smashed. And so, evidently, I could not use that finger, the index finger, to write with in a normal fashion. This finger was done and obtained and smashed during a shipwreck of the SS Byron Duncan right below the Sand Island Lighthouse in March the 6th of 1946. And being as this finger was in such bad condition, the index finger, of course, as you see, is functional. And as this long finger rests on the surface of the table or desk of which I would be writing, it obviously became necessary for me to shift the position of my pen so that that finger would not, as tender and as painful as it was, not rest on that surface, but be lifted above the surface slightly. So I shifted my pen and so that it would be between the long finger and the index finger and supported slightly with my thumb. In this fashion, I learned to write in three different handwritings. And, of course, to emphasize that this is three different handwritings using different forms of capital and small letters. And using this form of handwriting as well as the normal form of handwriting, I was able to, with the difference in penmanship, the difference in color, ink colors, to dramatize, deliberately dramatize what I wrote in those annotations so as to cause science, through its tender pride, to feel woefully behind the times and to be urged and spurred on into greater efforts to advance and to raise its level of knowledge, which they did during the IGY years, which followed only a couple of years after I wrote my annotations. And I discovered only a few years or so ago from members of the academic community with which I regularly and often associate with these IGY years were caused, mostly and mainly caused, spurred on by those annotations that I wrote claiming such superior knowledge.
Well, how did the academic and scientific community become aware of these annotations? How did they find out about them?
We must face the fact that in the prologue of, or the foreword of, the Navy Bureau of Research and Development edition, the so-called Anavarov edition, of the annotated Jessup book, annotated by myself.
I'm getting at is to get you to tell us how that book was distributed and how the scientists came to know about it.
Yes. Well, in the front of that book, they say that there were, in the letters to Jessup and to myself also, the Navy says that there, this book, the naval reprint, was made for the scientists of the old Bureau of Naval Research and Development and for colleagues, that is, fellow professors, also interested in force field functions, dynamics, and force field even as physics.
How many copies of this book was distributed?
As well as to France. As well as to France. To who, meaning industrial industries and universities who were contracted to the old Bureau of Naval Research and Development. All right. All of these, many people, the friends, the colleagues outside of the old Bureau of Research and Development, as well as all of the scientists inside of the Bureau of Research and Development, received by the Navy's own words, by what they wrote in that prologue, the foreword to the book, copies of this book. They all received this. And this, obviously, logically, considering that the Navy then employed well over 50 scientists in their I beg your pardon, it was well over 30 scientists, physicists, physical scientists, at the Bureau of Naval Research and Development facilities. They had to print more than 25 because there were more than 30 in the ONR alone. So logic informs you and all who thinking people that not only were there more than 25, because they printed them for one copy for each physical scientist there, and there were more than 30. So, plus four, the colleagues outside of what is now called the ONR, the Office of Naval Research, since it changed its name from Bureau of Naval Research and Development to ONR. Not only for colleagues outside, but also for friends, that is, people, universities and companies, even corporations that were contracted to the old Bureau of Naval Research and Development Science Establishment. This means that there were a colossally larger number than 25.
Would you say 100 copies?
No, I would not say 100 copies. I say more. I will tell you what. The president, Austin V. Stanton, of Varro Manufacturing Company, told me about a decade, 14 to 15 years ago, while he was still then president, and at our first meeting, he said, we printed 116 copies. I received two. Jessup received three. I destroyed my first copy because it was then and still possibly is today some of the world's most dangerous literature. The only scientists specializing in force field activity. There were logically at least 116, a minimum of 116. However, I later discovered that there were additional 25 that were printed for the Office of Naval Research many years after the old Bureau of Naval Research and Development had printed the first 116. Therefore, the naval officer who swore, he took on oath, on his word of honor, as a gentleman and an officer, and an afterwards trained man, who swore to Charles Burbage that the experimenting in invisibility, that is the absolute camouflage, is still going on. That officer was telling the logical truth. And therefore, when ONR says there were only 25 copies printed for ONR, it is telling the literal truth, but it is not mentioning the simple fact that for the old Bureau of Naval Research and Development scientists, the self-same men but under a different name, the self-same scientists just having a different name, now called the ONR. They're not mentioning that fact because the combined number would be more than 25 and would be implicative of the simple fact that research in this area of science is still going on, especially since 3 Julys ago, about 25 months ago, during the Soyuz Apollo mission, when an invisible star was found radiating in the 390-angstrom region of the ultraviolet and having such strong force field condensance, the density, that it proved my own statements of the past quarter of a century or more that invisibility can be achieved by using force fields and knowledge from Einstein's second unified field theory, as well as force fields and unified and ultraviolet light. My statement that this can be done, invisibility achieved through UV light and force fields, is proven to be true by the discovery of that star. There is no reason, therefore, for me to remain hidden away in old Mexico anymore. I come forth and rise above the surface and present myself to the public for this reason, because I want the public to know there really is a great benefit to be achieved from force field research, and to not condemn the Navy for trying to protect their secrets, as even companies and corporations, even your own selves, have your own personal secrets that you too also protect. Why condemn someone else for having and protecting their secrets likewise in the same similar manner?
I'd like to ask a question now.
What is my name?
Allende.
Thank you.
Allende, Mr. Allende. There is talk that you saw a ship disappear during an experiment which I believe some people have referred to as the Philadelphia experiment, and you were an actual witness to that. I wonder if you would confirm that, and if you can confirm it, if you could describe the incident for us.
I would like to say here and now that anything and everything that I and only I say by myself alone will be regarded always and forever by the scientific and academic community as merely nothing more than pure hearsay that has never been validated, confirmed, verified, nor corroborated, and that nobody, not one of you so-called the scientists in the pseudoscience of ufology, has even lifted a little finger to attempt to confirm, corroborate, and verify and validate what I have been saying for almost a quarter of a century in print. You accept my word alone? What am I? A fountain of wisdom? an authority? Let us face the simple fact. What I tell you, yes, is true. But you're going to be laughed at forever unless you yourselves go and do the research that logically needs to be done to verify, confirm, and corroborate and validate the statements that I make. I know that you are thusly caused to doubt what I have said. I want you to doubt, and I want you to doubt enough so as go ahead and see for yourselves whether or not what I have been saying for nearly a quarter of a century is so or not so. I say again, in my old age, in the 53rd year of my life, weak, emaciated, sick, and perhaps quite probably not too long to live, I may die soon from these sicknesses that I have. I say, yes, I saw the D-173 become invisible right before my eyes, right before my eyes. But I am not the only witness. And you intelligent people, you brilliant geniuses, never thought that there would be other witnesses in a whole convoy full of 107 or more ships. Right over my head in the gun tub, just immediately behind my head, were Navy, I repeat, Navy gunners from the armed guards who sailed on the same ships with us. There were Army personnel aboard that ship, too. There were witnesses who witnessed this. Same thing. They saw it the same time I did, at approximately 5:05 in the afternoon, on a nice, clear, sunshiny day. Beautiful, lovely day. Not a cloud to speak of in the sky. Only usual few clouds are naturally small clouds. The ship in front of us. You travel in convoy, each ship must be 500 feet apart from the other ship. The stern must be 500 feet from the bow of the ship behind it, and vice versa. No sailors on the ship in front of us, whatever the name of that ship was. I saw them watching with their eyes the same thing that I saw occurring before my eyes to the DE-173 as it became invisible within that 5 minute period of time. I am not the only witness in the world. God Christ, man, go find those other witnesses. Find the name of that convoy. Find the names of the ships in the convoy. Then get a list of all the crew members. And to do this, you must get first, I repeat, first, the ship's articles. It is a pink piece of paper, pasteboard. And it has the names of all the ship's crew members, of the merchant ship's crew members. And then get the ship's log in which the names and addresses of those people, those crew members that were on my ship, the SS Andrew Furuseth, are listed. Those addresses of all of the crew members. I mean all of them. Then go into the Navy records and find out for voyage number 3 that began on the October the 18th, 1943, from the Norfolk Hampton Roads shipping area around there. Find the Navy records for the Navy names and home addresses, repeat, home addresses of the Navy Armed Guard gunnery personnel that were on that ship, the SS Andrew Furuseth, and also witnessed this. Find the plot showing the position of each ship in that convoy and find the position of the SS Andrew Curtis as we crossed eastward across the Atlantic after that great hurricane. And find the name of the ship in front of the SS Andrew Curtis, and there on that ship you will find many other witnesses also. And the ship immediately to the port side, the two ships immediately to the port side, in the other lane of ships, the other lane of ships, you will get the names and addresses of the merchants and naval personnel aboard that ship, as well as the Army supercargo officer that always traveled on every merchant ship. It's his name, too. And then the other Army personnel being transported, such as we had on SS Andrew Furseth. We had Army personnel being taken to war. Here's their names, too. Collect all, I repeat, all of these witnesses. Don't look at me as if I am a fountain of wisdom, an authority to be accepted by all of science. Let us face the simple fact. Science regards my statements until 2 years ago, during the Soyuz July, Soyuz Apollo mission, rocket mission, space mission, when they discovered the invisible star. Until then, science regarded any statement that I made as absolutely ridiculous, and I repeat, ludicrously ridiculous. Poppycock. Absurd. Preposterous. Let us face the simple fact that, therefore, science still is imbued and suffused, impregnated with the idea that anything any ufologist says is therefore a lot of tommy rot. You must do this research or you fail yourselves and make yourselves look stupidly ridiculous, as well as you fail to validate the science of ufology into a real science instead of the pseudoscience it now is.
That concludes the tape, A Yendi Speaks. For a complete list of tapes, write to Saucerian Press Incorporated, Box 2228, Clarksburg, West Virginia, 26301.